Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. I am Justice Ann Gardner, and to my right is Justice Sue Walker, and to my left is Justice Bob McCoy. And we are your panel for this afternoon. And we appreciate you all being here. We're going to hear two cases in oral argument this afternoon, and several other cases that are being submitted without argument afterwards. And I'll go ahead and ask Bonnie to call the case, the first case.
The court will now call Tip Allison versus
Okay, thank you. Hi, Mr. Allison, are you ready to proceed? Okay. At your convenience.
Introduce myself. I'm Kip Allison, the appellant. This case arises from a sanction that was imposed by the court on October the 13th, 2011, and then a subsequent order entered on May 14th, 2013. The sanctions totaled $38,325.24, of which $33,235 were found to be jointly and severally between myself and my client at the time. The basis of the sanctions is there was two grounds pled. One was that the counterclaims and third-party claim filed by my client was a groundless and frivolous under both Chapter 13 and Chapter 10. And in addition, there was a affidavit that was alleged to be first fabricated, then false, then not properly notarized. Basis of our complaint is that we believe, of course, the standard is abuse of discretion, and we're asking the court to review the record in that the record does not support both suggested findings or the findings and the legal conclusions drawn by the court, nor does it support the sanctions that were imposed. The first count one, was groundless, and the plaintiffs were either 12 or 13. It's hard for me to discern exactly because one of them seems to be an unincorporated entity. There were 12 or 13 privately held corporations that were run by a family trust that was settled by Alan Meeker. Alan Meeker was divorcing Mindy Meeker at the time, which was in November of 2008. The 13 corporate entities and the trust sued Ms. Meeker for an alleged improper entry into their corporate offices.
That was in this lawsuit.
Sorry?
In this lawsuit in the trial court.
They're, okay. They're the plaintiff, and they sued. And that was in 2008, I believe. No, 2009. It was in 2009. And in 2010, really, it may have been in late 2008. I don't have that right in front of me, but the counterclaims were filed in 2010. That was originally filed, the divorce was filed in 2008, and the Comgas was filed in February 2009. And during the year of 2010 or 2009 going into 2010, the 12 or 13 private corporations hired a private investigator and placed the defendant, Ms. Meeker, under surveillance for almost 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Now, the testimony doesn't really suggest that it was constant and continual, but the testimony does support the fact that at any time Ms. Meeker had her children or had her children with her or was out in her yard traveling to or from work, that She testified that she was under surveillance, and that's consistent with the private investigator who testified in the sanctions hearing. And I think it's an important distinction that the private investigator, Mr. Ginn, who had four or five other people working for him, never testified in the divorce, never testified in the primary case. The only time Mr. Ginn ever testified, and the first time he ever testified, was in the sanctions hearing. The findings that the court the order for the sanctions states that the court found the following facts as as the basis of the groundless. Number one is that, and this is more of an admission, is the corporate entities hired the surveillance. That's not in dispute. That Ginn conducted the surveillance in public areas. Well, that is a disputed fact, and I don't believe anything in the record can impute that knowledge to me when I filed the claims, or I signed the pleading and filed the claims on behalf of Ms. Meeker at the time the counterclaim was filed, which was in July of 2010.
How long did they surveil Mrs. Meeker?
As best we can tell, based on the testimony of the investigators, because part of what happened in the divorce proceeding, all the corporate entities and the trustees were protected from discovery. Ms. Meeker was not allowed, even though it was her community estate that established the trust in combination with Mr. Meeker. The court had prohibited any discovery on those entities. So during the course of the divorce, there was no discovery allowed. The surveillance was based on the fact that they did it allegedly going to protect the children in the course of the divorce. But the corporate entities don't have any interest in Ms. Meeker as a private citizen getting a divorce.
Was it to keep, protect and observe whether she was complying with the divorce court's order not to have them around her boyfriend?
And what would a corporate interest be for that? How would IBM have a right to surveil a defendant, especially somebody they sued, to determine whether or not that citizen acted in accordance with a family court order? These corporations weren't in the divorce suit. They didn't have an interest in the divorce suit. They were prohibited from being in the divorce, and Ms. Meeker was prohibited from suing them in the divorce. So under what theory or basis of law did they have to follow her to attempt to enforce a court order? And as far as, I mean, I've been practicing a long time, and I don't believe any courts ever asked that a private citizen or a party put another party under surveillance to ensure that the court order was followed. So the allegation that they were doing it to protect the children is absolutely baseless.
Okay, the court didn't order that there be surveillance.
No, and that's a highly disputed fact, Your Honor.
That was meant to be a question. I wasn't taking it for granted.
Yeah, and the only time that that issue was actually litigated was in front of Judge Wells in April of 2010 when she issued her memorandum, which is plaintiff's exhibit or defendant's exhibit, Allison Dash 2, in which she enjoined Mr. Meeker from having Ms. Meeker surveilled.
Isn't it true that the trustee of the Children's Trust was the entity that paid for the surveillance?
It's a little bit confusing. There was claims that the trustee paid. There was claims that Conglomerate Gas paid. The entities were all either majority held or wholly held by the trust. The trustee never testified in any proceeding. The only person that ever testified in the divorce proceedings was Mr. Meeker. And he alleged that at certain times he was directing the private investigators as an officer of the corporation. There's times that he said that reports were circulated to the trustee, but there was never any evidence that the trust was actually paying or directing the private investigators. And I don't believe Mr. Ginn testified in the sanctions hearing that he ever spoke with Tracy Bolt, the trustee, and got directions from him. Our contention is that he was always being directed by Mr. Meeker, who from February of 2009, leading up to the hearings in 2010, sought primary possession of the two children. And to acquire that, he had used 24-hour surveillance to accumulate evidence and try to show a court that he should have the kids. That's what the hearings were about in early 2010. And when those concluded, that's when Ms. Meeker became aware, as I did, of all the surveillance that had gone on, all the reports that had been made, all the misinformation that had been disseminated. At that time,
Finish your statement, then I have a question.
At that time, we reviewed the evidence that came out in the April 2010 hearing. All the evidence that was, Ms. Meeker testified, her employer testified, a nanny testified, Mr. Meeker testified, and taking all that evidence and contrasting it to numerous cases of invasion of privacy, I came to believe there was a factual and legal basis for bringing the suit.
Didn't Mrs. Meeker testify or through affidavit offer averments that she was aware that she was being followed like every day when she would leave with the children or that they would?
It was a progressive process. Her testimony, when I reviewed the record, was that she became more and more aware of it. In other words, that in the beginning they tried to be clandestine, and then that became less of a purpose, and then they came more obvious, and then it culminated with her actually them being in a swimming pool with her when she was on vacation in Galveston. So she became aware of it, and that would be through the course of 2009. Whether she became aware of it or not doesn't seem to be a basis to whether or not I had a belief that there was a factual basis or legal basis to bring the suit. Whether or not I should be sanctioned or the appellant should be sanctioned, excuse me, I'm not sure how I should do this, but would be that there was not, that the claim was groundless, either factually or legally. There was no legal basis. If you read the defendants or the appellee's argument, they're claiming that because Ms. Meeker may have known about it, she waived her claim. Well, I'm not aware of that legal theory of waiver because she took 6 or 7 months or 8 months. The statute of limitations hadn't run. She could still bring her claim. The other is that she only became aware with full knowledge of how everybody testified and all the evidence and the conclusions of the hearings in 2010. She brought her claims 2 to 3 months after that. So then you go to broad and bad faith.
Wait, what about their contention that there was no legal basis for it because it all took place in public?
Well, first of all, how would I have known? Because whether it took place in the public arena is a disputed fact. It's highly disputed. Both, and Ms. Meeker has consistently said they invaded her private space, her private arena. So that's a disputed fact. So
well, in what way?
Sticking to this record, the affidavit that was a part of the divorce record that was admitted in the sanctions hearing as Allison 1 was the response to a summary judgment that had about an 86-page affidavit attached to it. In that affidavit, she included a number of incidences as well as what she testified to. And so that's the knowledge that I have when I'm ascertaining or making a decision on whether there's a legal basis or not.
I was just asking for an example.
Say it again.
I was just asking for an example.
They forced her to stop on her way back from Galveston. They followed her into when they privately paid to go visit NASA. They were following her and followed her into that space. They followed her into a private party where she was in a runner's group, I believe, and she was not with her kids. She was with a running club. They were in a private function, and there was some evidence or some testimony that they had followed her into that. And so, but going the reverse, it would have to be I would have to be aware that there was no basis. or that I knew that they would never not followed her except in a public place. And I don't think that, I mean, if you're looking at Webb doesn't say that. Webb, it was a nuisance case, which is the case they rely on. Kramer is an invasion of privacy case. And clearly there, the defendant was always in a public place and never engaged in illegal activity. And the court still found that it was an invasion of privacy. I'm on my yellow. So I've got one other point on the affidavit. There was Ms. Meeker, for I say a self-serving purpose, made allegations after I'd been terminated and I was not present that we had applied her signature to an affidavit that proved to not be true. The court found that it was not true. The court found that we did not falsely apply her signature. We did not falsely include information that was not true. She testified that everything in the affidavit was true. What ultimately was ascertained, and it was not clear in the record because they didn't call Ms. Smith, who was a notary, is that they claimed that the notary was not done in person. I don't have any personal knowledge, nor did I have any personal knowledge at the time of how the notary was completed. I did not become aware of a defect in the affidavit.
Okay, your time's up, and you're reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal. Okay, thank you. And so we will hear from Mr. Warren. No, okay. I'm sorry. Sharon Fulgham.
That's right. May it please the court.
Counsel.
This case was filed after Ms. Meeker broke into our clients' offices, stole their documents, installed spyware on their computers, and then promptly delivered the stolen documents to appellant Mr. Allison. When he was requested to turn the documents back over to our clients, repeatedly he refused, and we were forced to bring this lawsuit. That backdrop's important here because the credibility of the witnesses was very much at issue, and the trial court was in the best position to judge that credibility in making its determinations. The trial court's award of sanctions was not an abuse of discretion because the evidence before the court supported the finding that Mr. Allison had filed a groundless claim, and he did so with an improper purpose. And sanctions were separately awarded and proper because of the false document that he represented to the court was an affidavit when it in fact was not. Now, an invasion of privacy claim requires three elements. One, that there be an intrusion, a physical or otherwise, that it be highly offensive to the reasonable person, and that it's unjustified or unwarranted. Mr. Allison filed the claim against my clients knowing that he would be unable to prove the first and the third elements. He knew that because he was Ms. Meeker's attorney in the divorce proceeding that gave rise to the surveillance. Now, I just heard for the first time that the fact that the surveillance was from a public place at all times or a private place where Mr. Ginn had a right to be, that's the first time I've heard that that's in dispute. It wasn't raised in the hearings. It wasn't raised in Mr. Allison's appellate brief. I encourage you to read the affidavit that was filed by Ms. Meeker because it doesn't say that any of the incidents occurred from non-public places. That is just not a fact that's in the record.
Well, Mr. Ginn, is that how you pronounce his name?
Yes, Your Honor.
Testified that he would, or his men would drive into her driveway to turn around. At least that's one thing that I read that indicates that they did go onto her property.
Your Honor, if you read that, then I'm sure that it's in there. I know that that wasn't an issue before Judge Birdwell, whether the conduct where he was watching Ms. Meeker and the children was typically from a whole street away, several 50 to 100 feet, I believe is what was in the record, or to the extent it was on private property, it was at a hotel that's open to the public or at a restaurant that's open to the public.
Okay, but is the appellee's contention that, as I understand the brief, though, that because all or most of it was in a public place, that is a legal factor that makes the claim groundless because the law is so well developed that it could not be argued that it amounted to an invasion of privacy.
Yes, Your Honor.
That makes sense.
That is our position.
Okay.
That the fact that the observation was from the public falls well within the Texas jurisprudence that says if you're in public, if you can be seen from the public, you have no expectation of privacy. And that was certainly the case here. We think that the cases in throughout Texas that say if you're standing in front of an open window and you can be seen from the street, you've got no expectation of privacy. That's what we have here. We don't have a case where they're looking over a 6-foot-tall privacy fence from a ladder and taking pictures into a kitchen window. Everything that was seen, Ms. Meeker and her children, was seen from public purview. And that's why the claim was groundless. Mr. Allison knew those facts when he signed and filed the counterclaim. And secondly, courts are to look at why it was filed. And here, the facts surrounding the circumstances of the filing show that it was done for an improper purpose. If you look at the timing, the family divorce case had settled in June 2010. July 2010, 1 month later, we were 1 month out from trial on the civil case. And that is when this claim was filed. And after Mr. Allison filed the claim, he took the position that, in fact, we had both released our claims in the divorce. It was the month before. There was a settlement, and there was a provision where the appellant was requesting that the parties release their claims against each other, and he took the position that that meant the civil case. We had released our claims against each other.
Well, there was some discussion of it in the agreement on the record, at least, wasn't there?
That's right. There was a question as to whether the parties had agreed to release their claims, but this claim was filed after that agreement was supposedly reached, and then appellant took the position that we had released the claims against each other. Well, why did he file a lawsuit then, or file a counterclaim, if he believed those had been released? So that's another factor going into the trial court's determination that this was brought for an improper purpose and it was groundless. As far as the one case that appellant seems to hang his hat on, Kramer, it was a very different case. It was out of the Dallas Court of Appeals almost exactly 30 years ago, and it was a harassment and a stalking case. An ex-girlfriend was stalking her ex-boyfriend, who was married with children, every day for years. She was sitting outside of his house. She was showing up at restaurants and making sexual comments and completely harassing and stalking behavior. And notably, that was prior to any anti-stalking statute being in effect. That's not the case we have here. We have a professional private investigator. He was following Texas Department of Public Safety for private investigator rules. He was acting professionally, as were the people that were working for him. He was not harassing. He was not stalking.
But didn't they follow her every day for a year?
Your Honor, they followed her when she had the children, or when they thought she may have the children, because there were questions about whether she was complying with the family court's restrictions that were in place about her seeing her paramour in the presence of the children.
And would they sometimes look into her car or drive up alongside the car and look in to see if she was, to use Mr. Ginn's words, secreting the children from view?
Yes, there may have been one or two instances like that because they didn't want to follow her when she didn't have the children. They would try to confirm that she had the children in her presence. And I know at one time she had hidden the children, like in the trunk or down low, where they wouldn't be seen by the private investigators. So there was certainly cause for them to try to find out whether or not she actually had the children, and they would stop the surveillance if she didn't.
Okay. And didn't they sometimes follow her as closely as 30 to 50 feet behind her when she was driving?
The testimony was that they tried to keep a safe distance, a safe driving distance, and I think 30 to 50 feet was mentioned, but there was obviously no measuring going on. They were just trying to be safe and yet keep tabs on where she was going with the children.
Okay.
Did the trustee of the Children's Trust pay for the surveillance, or is that a fact issue?
Your Honor, I am not sure off the top of my head who paid for the... I know that the trust had hired Mr. Ginn, and the trust, I know, was compared to IBM, and I don't think that's a fair comparison because the trust was actually established for the children and for the benefit of the children, and that's its exclusive purpose. So I think it's a bit different that a trust that's established for the benefit of children is paying for the investigators who are ensuring that the mother is complying with her family.
So where is the, where in the record is the evidence or the indication that the trust was paying for the surveillance?
Your Honor, I would have to consult the record and get back to you with an exact cite on that.
That's what your motion for sanctions says, is that the trust was paying for the surveillance.
Okay, Your Honor, I know that the trust did hire Mr. Ginn, so I assume that they would be paying for the surveillance as well. And again, the trust was for the benefit of the children, and the trust was actually brought into the divorce proceeding by appellant. So to the fact he's saying that it's this corporate entity that has no interest in the benefit of the children, that's not true, because it was established for the benefit of the children, and then he and Ms. Meeker actually brought the trust in to the divorce proceeding. So the trust was involved, and the trust did hire Mr. Ginn, you're right.
Does that get us into issues of whether the trust was established with community property and who was in control, who made the decisions, and were they both trustees? And during that period of time, who made the decision for the trust to hire the private investigators? Or does it not get us into that issue? Do we not look at that?
Your Honor, I don't think that that's at issue here, because what this court needs to consider is whether the evidence supported the findings by the trial court that Mr. Allison's conduct was inappropriate. And indeed it was, because he filed a groundless pleading and he did so with an improper purpose. I don't think that the issue of who was paying for the private investigator comes into play at all. And with regard to the affidavit, the issue before the court, as I understand it from appellant's pleadings, is whether he knew that the affidavit was false. And while there is no statement on the record that I knew this affidavit was false, there is a plethora of circumstantial evidence from which the trial court and this court can conclude that he knew the affidavit was false.
The factual statements in it were false? Were you referring to the factual statements in the affidavit as being false? Or are you referring to her signature and notarization?
Your Honor, we're referring to the fact that she didn't sign the affidavit in front of a notary and swear that its contents were true. And the fact that after she signed a document that was not notarized, faxed it back to appellant, there were changes made to the body of the document, and then appellant's paralegal signed and affixed her notary stamp. A few hours later, after not having seen Ms. Meeker at his offices, appellant filed that very affidavit in connection with a response to our summary judgment and said it was a true and correct copy of an affidavit. He made representations to the court. He made representations to our clients that it was, in fact, an affidavit when he knew that it had never been sworn to. It was merely fabricated, and the contents of it were altered after he had given a draft to his client. And the trial court made that determination, and he deemed that it was, in fact, a sanctionable offense, and we respectfully agree. The last issue that was raised in the appeal by Mr. Allison was the segregation of fees. And again, we respectfully disagree that the fees weren't segregated. Mr. Warren went through painstaking detail to color code and explain the reasons how he segregated the fees in his affidavit. That was considered by the court, and the fees were awarded. And if there are no further questions.
As to sanctions against Mrs. Meeker, has she simply not appealed those as to her,
That's okay. Correct. Okay. She has not appealed.
All right.
And as Mr. Ginn, he is not here today, but he was brought into this case only on the basis of the invasion of privacy claim. So all of his fees would be in regard to defending himself against the invasion of privacy claim.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Fulton. Mr. Allison, rebuttal.
Again, what I would remind the court is that the standard determination of whether a claim was filed was groundless is the knowledge known to the attorney at the time the claim was filed. There's no evidence in the record, nor is any of the evidence about what Mr. Ginn says he did relevant to what I knew at the time the claim was filed. I knew,
but go ahead. Doesn't the rule say that based on, to the best of their knowledge, information and belief formed after reasonable inquiry?
Yes, ma'am. And
it's not just your knowledge, it's knowledge after reasonable inquiry.
Yes, and my reasonable inquiry had accumulated through a four-day hearing that had taken place in Judge Wells' court. I'd listened to over five witnesses testify to the consequences of the surveillance. I had admitted multiple photographs of the proximity of the private investigators. There was evidence that they had run lights, they had cut off Miss Meeker, that the children were suffering from that process. There was substantial evidence that I had taken into account. Mr. Ginn didn't testify at that proceeding, and there was no evidence put on in any of those proceedings that he was only in a public place, but I allege that it doesn't matter if he was in a public place. There's no basis for them to claim that I cannot rely on a valid case that is still good law that has not been overturned. And even using their case from Webb, the end result was you had very misbehaving neighbors who had put up surveillance cameras. It was a nuisance claim. The jury found that the conduct of the Webbs was a nuisance. The issue on appeal was whether or not the cameras that the Webbs had on their house that pointed outward into the neighborhood, if that was an overbroad injunction saying that those cameras could not stay there. So the whole concept that the Webbs are doing is they're videotaping what's going on around their neighborhood, and the courts allowed it. Senate remanded it back to the trial court for some limitations, but they didn't take it away. So Webb stands for the fact that you don't have carte blanche to just reach out and watch what everybody's doing in their public arena. Same thing is addressing their idea that the suit was filed for an improper purpose. Yes, there was supposedly a mutual release. Plaintiffs had not dismissed their suit. 30 days out from trial is the last date for Ms. Meeker to file any amendment to preserve any claim that she might have. If they had agreed that there was a mutual release, everything would have been released. Had I not filed the claims on the last day they could be filed, I believe that she would have waived them, and I believe that would have been improper on my part. But it doesn't take away from the fact that she had the claims. They were real. And the idea that the corporations can follow her around while she's in a divorce, feeding information to her husband, who's an officer of the corporations, is contrary to what privacy really is. Last thing I would like to mention is that, again, there's no evidence that they're putting on that I knew what the investigators were doing. What I was able to rely on is what my client provided me, and there was substantial evidence as to what she provided me. There's also no evidence that I knew that a notary had not followed her notary oath. Testimony that's in the record was that I had prepared the motion. We had tried to get Ms. Meeker in. She had not come in. I left it for my paralegal to have communication with her. Ms. Meeker made all these false allegations that ultimately over 2 days of hearings proved to be not true. But I got sanctioned for that, and I got charged for their attorney's fees, proving that Ms. Meeker had lied. But ultimately, the affidavit could be called defective, but it wasn't false. Had I known that there was a defect and I pointed it out, the court would have probably allowed me to cure it. But I didn't know it was defective. I didn't have any idea there was a defect until they filed the motion for sanctions. I got sanctioned for not taking remedial measures. I didn't know about it. Didn't have any idea. And they didn't call Ms. Smith, who I believe would have explained the process she used and what she did. But I were afraid to do that, so they didn't call her. And now they just ask you to rely on what seems to be mystic information. I testified I did not know. I didn't tell her to act contrary to her notary rules. I didn't do that. Oh,
I had a question about the 4-day hearing you referred to that was in the divorce case that brought out information that you used in filing the counterclaim.
Yes, ma'am.
And I was wondering if that was made a part of this record.
Well, there was when Ms. Meeker testified in the sanctions proceeding, my attorney had her put on extensively what she testified to in that hearing, what evidence was placed, the fact that there was photographic evidence, the fact that the nanny testified, she testified to those things, and there was no contrary evidence put on in the sanctions hearing. I also testified to the same thing when I was called as a witness.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thanks to counsel for both parties, groups of parties, and we appreciate your arguments and your briefing, and I will say that your case is submitted and you are excused.